calculation going on at every stage. How does he manage to be both? There are times when he comes close, for me, to Bach in that incredible synthesis of the intellectual emotion. There is no composer of Brahms's time who has such an amazing faculty for bringing form to feeling. That maybe was his greatest legacy.
But then why then do we have this, does this image persist of him then, as this greybeard writing sort of brown music? You know, Victorian drawing rooms, brown colours, that sort of thing. I wonder, both of you, if performance practice has something to do with this.
There's a sort of Teutonic way, a sort of modern Teutonic way of playing Brahms, which is just very boring, you know, slow, solid, sort of mezzo forte to forte. Brahms himself didn't play like that. I mean, the critics complained that Brahms spread almost every chord in slow movements. Mm. And Moritz Rosenthal, who heard him, said the same thing. In other words, he played a bit like Paderewski and you know, the Lechitsky people, this sort of... And the pianists he liked best were all pianists of the Liszt school. They were sort of people like Dalbert and this sort of thing.
The virtuosos,
yes. So, and he also apparently had what he called elastic tempo. So the tempo was very, very much a romantic style.
Yes. And the other thing is you hear or you play on the pianos of Brahms's time, and they just, the sound isn't as thick. Mm. You play one of those big, thick, one of those big, thick lower chordal textures. And it's a different kind of sound. It's a different kind of articulation. Brahms loved the older instruments. He was a bit of a reactionary when it came to instrumental development in his own time. He specifically asked for the old unvalved horn in his marvellous horn trio. He was a horn player himself. And I do think sometimes, you know, you look at those scores, you see the way he accents rhythms. He clearly wants something lighter on its feet than the way it tends to come over in modern orchestral performances.
Especially orchestral performances is the problem there.
For example, the Meiningen Orchestra that Hans von Bülow conducts, it was a very unusual orchestra. Bülow was a slave driver. He rehearsed them incessantly. It was a small ensemble, utterly precise. They played standing up from memory. The orchestra played standing up from memory. Not the cellist and double bass, of course, that would be asking too. I mean, they were like a military unit. So you just imagine...
That was new pieces too, wasn't it? So if they're learning a new Brahms symphony, you had to learn the whole thing.
And Bülow premieres some of the Brahms works. So there's this sort of enormous precision he wants, but yet Bülow is also somebody who believes in romantic flexibility and tempo rubato, etc., etc. But I think the final thing is that one of the reasons for Brahms' slightly grey reputation is the sort of music he writes. He doesn't write symphonic poems with big titles like My Exciting Day in the Alps or something like that. He doesn't write operas called The Sufferings of Young Werther or whatever, or Tristan und Isolde, or The End of the World in the Ring. He writes something called String Quartet Number 1 or Symphony Number 3 and with no subtitles. And of course he does that because of the German tradition, because he hates Berlioz and Liszt, this idea of program music. He's not so much personally anti-Werther, but he's pigeonholes anti-Wagner. He doesn't write an opera, so that's why he's grey in that sense.
But again, I wonder, is that just another beard-like mask and smoke screen? Stephen, you alluded to this. I mean, because the point is, he knew that this music was expressing something. You know, I mean, he wasn't just writing music to be part of this tradition. I mean, what then does this music express? You know, if it's obvious and clear, we think what Wagner and Liszt meant, what does fundamentally Brahms' music express? You mentioned pain, Stephen, but
I do feel, and again, you know, one has to remember those very, very wise words of the philosopher Ernst Bloch, that when we talk about music, what we're really talking about is ourselves. And, you know, there is always, you know, one can only feel what one has the potential to feel in response to music. And yet, it does seem to me often, I mean, there is really quite strong evidence that Brahms had a serious depressive tendency. And wasn't it Eusebius Mandachevsky who said on one occasion, when Brahms is in particularly good spirits, he sings, "The grave is my joy." There are moments of almost heartbreaking sadness and I don't know whether you've had the same experience, Ken, but I certainly have, you know, just playing some of those late piano pieces recently and thinking, my God, this takes you to... In the second piano concerto, that extraordinary moment where it eventually the climax of the whole piece turns out to be in a hushed duet for clarinet and piano, almost as though you're taken out of the concert hall into the Lieder Salon and someone is singing to you very intimately. These moments are of such intensity. Or the finale of the Fourth Symphony, where he revives an archaic practice nobody'd heard of called Passacaglia, and builds an entire movement in this very structured way, and doing so something mightily and magnificently tragic. The combination of that in his best music of that formal control with this incredible focused intensity of expression is like nobody else in his time.
Look, both of you, I feel you've both done more to reclaim Brahms in the last half an hour than generations of scholars. Ken Hamilton, Stephen Johnson, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Tom's service at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening with our Proms Plus intro, looking at Brahms, the man behind the music, which couldn't really be more appropriate given that he's at the heart of the concerts here in the Royal Albert Hall over the next couple of days. Well, welcome back from me, Martin Handley, to the second part of this All Brahms BBC Prom being given by the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Well, we've heard the symphony, now it's the concerto, Brahms' first for the piano, in which the soloist is Emmanuel Ax. But before we get back to the music itself, the COE celebrates its 30th birthday this year. Earlier today, I spoke to its chairman, Peter Redman, who's been involved right from the start.
The founder members of the group came together in May 1981 in London. We put on a concert, and that was the birth of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And as it happened, Claudio Bardo, who was a great friend of many of the musicians, said that, look, I'll come along if I can. And he was actually with the LSO at the time. He turned up on the hall, and James Judd, who was conducting it, just walked up the central aisle and handed him the baton and said, over to you to conduct the second half of the concert. So that was a fairly startling moment for everybody in the hall that night. Only 250-odd people. But nevertheless, that was the beginning. And the heart and the soul of COE has continued with 18 of the founder members who were sitting on the platform that night, still sitting in the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, and indeed on the platform here at the Proms in 2011, 30 years later. And of that 18, half of them have all married each other, and now we have an orchestra with somewhere close to 60 children as a result of marriages within the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And if I just mention, as I looked this just this morning and stared at the rehearsal, I saw Marika leading. Well, Marika was a founder member of this orchestra and one of the ladies and girls. Actually, she was a teenager, as it happens, a late teenager, when I first met her in 1980 in Salzburg. She's leading the violins, as she has done now for over 25 years. Enno Senft, our principal bass, was leading the basses in May 1981. And Will Conway, the lead cello tonight at the Proms, was also leading the cellos in May 1981. So I just looked around the orchestra and sort of saw a sea of faces, all of whom I've known all my life.
Peter Redman. Well, Brahms was just 20 when his friend and mentor Schumann said of him, I thought sooner or later someone would appear destined to give the ideal expression to the spirit of the times. His name is Johannes Brahms. So no pressure then. And it got even worse when Schumann died at just 46 and Brahms, who was half that age, was thrown into the centre of German musical life. He wasn't surprisingly hesitant about writing anything ambitious. The first piano concerto actually began life as a two-piano sonata, turned into a symphony before ending up in its final form. It took him about 5 years in all to complete what was, amazingly, given its complexity, length and maturity, his first important symphonic work. Its origins were directly to do with Schumann. The plunging theme of the first movement was Brahms' graphic attempt to come to terms with the day his friend tried to kill himself by throwing himself into the River Rhine, an event which marked the start of Schumann's final two-year illness. Brahms originally wrote the first words of the Benedictus above the opening of the elegiac slow movement. Could it have been intended as part of a requiem mass for Schumann? Well, perhaps, but later Brahms also told Schumann's wife, Clara, with whom he was in love, it was a portrait of her. But anyway, why shouldn't music be as complicated as life? The finale is serious, if not tragic, before the green shoots of hope lead to final triumph. Brahms' model, Schumann's piano concerto, which itself contained elements of Beethoven's third. Those two men being, of course, the composers in whose footsteps Brahms was most in awe of treading, Emmanuel Ax and Bernard Haitink joining the Chamber Orchestra of Europe to perform Brahms' first piano concerto.
Thank you.
triumphant end to Brahms' first piano concerto, one of his most deeply personal work, performed to end this BBC Prom in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3 by Emmanuel Axe. That big cheer for him with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, led by Marika Blankenstein and conducted by Bernard Haitink. And at the end of that performance, Bernard Haitink just leant on the rail and looked at Manny Axe as if to say, there, that was something. Patted him on the shoulder, the two just looked at each other and grinned. At the end of the first movement in rehearsal this morning, Bernard Haitink leant over and said, anything? As if, you know, and Manny Axe said, no, nothing. And there was also another lovely moment when the end of the first movement, double basses, Bernard Haitink wasn't quite sure, and he said, was it all right? Well, maybe I wasn't right, but you were fine, with a great smile to the basses. And he's going off, shaking hands with the principals of all the string sections. They really commune with the music and with each other, this orchestra, this conductor, this soloist. And it's as though Manuel Axe is sort of feeling the orchestra's pulse and also demanding it, looking at them the way he does. Well, they're all off, apart from Manuel Axe, to Lucerne to do Brahms symphonies next week. Back comes Emmanuel Axe on his own. Bravo, hands clenched to the band as he comes to take his bow. Bernard Haitink, modest as always, leaving the limelight to Manny Axe. Well, 31 years ago, chairman of the orchestra, Peter Redman, was dragged away from his honeymoon to talk to members of the European Community Youth Orchestra, who wanted to stay together and form a new chamber orchestra. 18 of them are still here, including Marika Blankenstein, who's led the orchestra for 25 years. 15 different nationalities on the platform here tonight. Bernard Haitink may return in a moment, one hopes. He's off to Lucerne with the orchestra to finish the Brahms cycle. Got a bit of a holiday, but then Berlin, Chicago and New York, a very full autumn, he doesn't slow up much. Back they come together, absolutely together. Bernard Haitink with his arm round Manny Axe as they come. A huge applause from the orchestra, who adore Haitink, and getting them up. Well, if you're now in the Brahms groove, don't go anywhere, because he dominates the next 24 hours here in the Albert Hall, and of course on Radio 3. We're back at 10 tonight for the pianist Angela Hewitt in late Brahms intermezzos, before she's joined by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and Andrew Manzi for neglected Schumann, when Brahms returns his G minor piano quartet as orchestrated by Schoenberg. And of course, tonight's magnificent combination of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, Emmanuel Axe and Bernard Haitink, returns at 7:30 tomorrow evening for Brahms' second piano concerto and fourth symphony. Revelatory Brahms here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. But for the next hour or so, let's relax back at base in Broadcasting House in the company of Jill Anderson.
Thanks very much. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. That's here on Radio 3. Or you can listen to it whenever you want over the next 7 days via the BBC iPlayer. Well, our next programme is at 9:15, and it's the second part of North of South Revisited, a look at Tanzania after its years of colonial rule. So, to take us up to that, let's hear more music by Brahms, but this time for voices. Here are three motets, opus 110. They are Ich aber bin elend, Ich arme Welt, Ach arme Welt, and Wenn wir in höchsten Nöten sein. And they're sung by the Dresden Kreuzchor, conducted by Roderich Kreiler.
Thank you.
three motets by Brahms, Opus 110. They were sung by the Dresden Kreuzchor, conducted by Roderich Kreiler. Well, the pianist Angela Hewitt will be playing Brahms and Schumann in our next prom, and that starts at 10 o'clock. So let's hear her now playing Chopin. This is the Nocturne in G minor, Opus 37, number 1.
Thank you.
Angela Hewitt was playing Chopin's Nocturne in G minor, Opus 37, number 1. And she'll be playing in our prom, which you can hear live here on Radio 3 at 10 o'clock. She'll play two of the three intermezzos, Opus 117, and Schumann's Introduction and Concert Allegro. Also in the programme, Brahms arranged by Schoenberg, the Piano Quartet number 1, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Manzi. This is Radio 3, it's 9:15, and now we've another chance to hear the second part of North of South Revisited. The early 1960s were a heady time for Africa, as the wind of change swept through the continent, bringing self-governance and freedom from colonial rule to many countries. Nearly two decades later, the Trinidadian writer Shiva Naipaul travelled through East Africa to find what liberation meant to people then and how it had changed their lives. His book, North of South, has been described as one of the best travel books of all time and was required reading for anyone interested in Africa in the early 1980s. In tonight's programme, the Ugandan journalist Joel Kibazo retraces Naipaul's journey to see how much has changed. Tonight, he follows Naipaul to Tanzania, formerly Tanganyika, which celebrated Uhuru, or independence, in 1961.
I travelled by bus from Mombasa to the Kenya-Tanzania border town of Taveta, a dusty, disordered collection of mud huts and wooden shacks roofed with corrugated iron. We crowded off the bus with our luggage and were shepherded into a small brick building housing immigration control.
The Trinidadian writer Shiva Naipaul was travelling through East Africa in the late 1970s. In his book, North or South, he reflects on the people he met on his journey and asks the question, what did liberation mean to people 20 years after independence?
How wide is the gap between the rhetoric of liberation and its day-to-day manifestations? How much cynicism is there? How much apathy? Do the people actually care? What are they like as individuals? Should we despair or should we continue to hope? Beyond all this, but not entirely unconnected with it, is the relationship of black and white and brown.
As Africa celebrates the 50th anniversary of 17 African nations this year, with others following shortly afterwards, I'll be revisiting those questions posed by Shiva Naipaul. As a Ugandan and a child of the independence era, I'm curious to find out how have things changed since Naipaul wrote North of South three decades ago.
The officer in charge ordered me to take off my hat, in deference, I suppose, to the portrait of Kenyatta hanging on the wall behind him. Do you have any Kenyan shillings on you? Show me your wallet. He extracted the 200 shillings, turned the wallet upside down and shook it vigorously. Satisfied that there was nothing more to be had, he returned the wallet, carefully folded the Kenyan notes and put them into his shirt pocket. I protested, but there was nothing I could do. I was aware that Kenyan currency was in great demand in Tanzania on the black market. We climbed back into the bus and set off for the Tanzanian post, a few hundred yards further on. Once more, we crowded out of the bus with our luggage. The passengers, nearly all Tanzanian peasants, looked visibly tense as they carried their boxes, baskets, and cloth-wrapped bundles for inspection. It was clear that customs inspection on this side of the border was no mere ritual. Hat in hand, I went over to the customs officer. One corner of the platform was occupied by a small but growing pile of confiscated goods. With a small grunt of triumph, he fished out from my suitcase that half bottle of whiskey I was carrying. "And what is this?" "Whiskey." He revolved the bottle. "You cannot take this into Tanzania, Bwana. It is illegal to smuggle spirits into Tanzania." I wasn't smuggling. I gazed at him indignantly. "I do not make the law, Bwana," he shrugged. "I only do what the law says I must do." He handed the bottle to a minion who ostentatiously bore it off toward the pile of confiscated material.
In 1961, British ruled Tanganyika gained independence, followed in 1963 by the islands of Zanzibar. The two countries then united to form what is now modern Tanzania in January 1964. The first president, Julius Nyerere, had a socialist vision for the country.
Over the years, President Julius Nyerere of Tanzania has adopted something of the character and style that Nehru affected in the first years of Indian independence, claiming a special place in the moral firmament for himself, his policies, and by extension, his country.
It is the task of finding a common denominator which will guide us in our determination to rid our continent of the remaining vestiges of colonialism.
He is just about the only African head of state one can contemplate without immediate sensations of outrage or embarrassment. Here, astonishing as it may seem, is an African leader with pretensions to intellectual respectability. He has translated Shakespeare into Swahili. He makes it possible to believe, if only for a little while, that Africa can be taken seriously, that Africa wants to liberate itself.
I've come to the University of Dar es Salaam to meet one of Tanzania's most distinguished academics.
My name is Isai Shivji, and I was honored to be appointed to this Mwalimu Nyerere professorial chair in Pan-African Studies. As young people, we lived through that period, which was in Tanzania, as many other African countries, a period of intense nationalism.
Professor, Julius Nyerere had a vision for Tanzania of a socialist society. But by the time he had left the presidency, he acknowledged that perhaps that had been the wrong path for Tanzania. Do you agree with that?
He did not quite acknowledge that it was the wrong path. He did acknowledge there are some things that he would have not done. Although, of course, it proclaimed socialism, but if you look deeply into the Arusha Declaration, it was essentially a nationalist document. And Nyerere defined the task. First, the state has to develop. In other words, it's the agency for development, because we have no other agency in society which will develop the country. The state has to do it. For this country, he also had a unique vision of building a society of equals, which was socialism, self-reliance. It was a kind of vision which inspired people at the time. Thousands of people flooded the streets in support of the Arusha Declaration.
The declaration proclaims that the party is at war with poverty and oppression. Now we want a revolution, it declares, a revolution that brings to an end our weakness so that we are never again exploited, oppressed, or humiliated. Inherent in the Arusha Declaration is a commitment to the belief that there are more important things in life than the amassing of riches, and that if the pursuit of wealth clashes with things like human dignity and social equality, then the latter will be given priority.
What does independence mean to Tanzanians today, most of whom are under 30 and have no experience of colonialism or the heady days leading to independence?
Dar es Salaam began with the sprinkling of factories merging into dense suburbs of shanty-lined alleys. Overburdened buses of Romanian origin swayed and jolted along the potholed highway. Crowds of men shuffled along the dusty roadside heading towards the city. An even greater number squatted idly in the thick roadside dust. Lines of washing hung from the balconies of moss-blackened tenements. Everywhere, dust, neglect, decay. The unpainted facades of the buildings, the potholes, the unswept and crumbling pavements told of a city that was falling to pieces.
There is so much building. Look, that's a what? 10-story building. Next to it is Access Bank, again another skyscraper. But opposite it is the Village Museum, showing you what was the original idea of these villages that were to be constructed during the Ujamaa period. So while you may go to a 10-story bank building across the road, you're reminded of, in many ways, where Tanzania has come from in the last 30 years or so.
If you look at the pictures of 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the landscape has changed dramatically. Dar es Salaam is like a construction site. Everywhere you go, you see constructions. Hospitals, schools, roads, bridges, new buildings are coming up.
I've come to the five-star Kilimanjaro Hotel to meet January Makambe, who's the special assistant to the president of Tanzania, His Excellency Jakaya Kikwete.
This hotel, the Kempinski itself, where we are, also is a big story about Tanzania. This used to be the Kilimanjaro Hotel, the one and the only five-star hotel back in the 70s, where important meetings regarding Africa's liberation and all these things took place. And then somehow in the 90s, it was run down, it was closed for a number of years, and the government looked for a buyer. No one came up until an investor from the Middle East came in, bought it, refurbished it, and renamed it. But this hotel itself is a story of Tanzania as well.
30 years ago, when Shivanai Paul was traveling through Tanzania, things were very different.
Those days, actually, you're very right. I mean, it's quite tough. I'm only 36, but I'm old enough to remember living in a village with my grandmother, and we'll have to go to line up to buy sugar and soaps and all these other things that now we take for granted.
How do you think Tanzania was transformed from that era to now? What is it that brought about the change?
Well, I mean, obviously, 1985, when Nyerere left, and the new leadership thought that perhaps a different direction would be appropriate, welcoming free market liberalization of the economy, private shops allowed, and all those things. From then on, it has been an era of reforms in all sectors of a society to really open up the economy and allow private enterprise to really take the lead as the engine of the economy.
You're a young person in Tanzania. Can you see Tanzania going back to that kind of period?
No, that's absolutely... Of course, I would not want to, but I think it's impractical. 70% of Tanzanians are under 30, so it's quite a young nation, and that has political and social significance.
On the umbrella-shaded terrace of the New Africa Hotel, people were having breakfast and reading newspapers. It looked promising. The reception clerk took a long time making up his mind as to whether or not he could offer me a room. I was surprised that the hotel was so full, being well aware that Tanzania's tourist trade was languishing. He concluded that he could offer me a room, but I would, he warned, have to wait until the room was cleaned, an operation that could take 1 hour, 2 hours, or even 3 hours.
This is the New Africa Hotel, which has been in Dar es Salaam for many, many years. And this is where Shivanai Paul came and stayed and had such appalling service. He was completely put out and disgusted with the kind of service levels that there were in Tanzania.
I bought a newspaper and went out to the terrace. My waiter was strolling nonchalantly among the tables. I called him over. What's happened to my breakfast? It's coming.
When?
15 minutes later, he returned. It will soon be ready. The cook forgot. My breakfast arrived. I noticed there was no butter and asked for some. Butter you cannot have.
Why not?
Because there is none. The coffee I poured into my cup turned out to be tea. Is anything wrong, Bwana? The waiter looked at me worriedly. Everything is fine, just fine. Since you are satisfied with my service, you will give me a nice tip?
Tipping is illegal in Tanzania. Do you want me to break the law?
He giggled. I think you are a capitalist, Rhoda.
I handed him a 100-shilling bill.
I want all my change back.
15 minutes later he returned, the bill intact.
Change you cannot have. The cashier has not yet been to the bank.
We've come to the Bandari restaurant at the New Africa Hotel to actually have a power lunch, advertised in one of the local
magazines, and it says, "Since the best deals often happen not in a boardroom, but over lunch, work out a perfect deal over a perfect luncheon at the Bandari Grill as you iron out those finer details." But when you turn to the actual menu, it's a sort of actually standard fare menu with steaks and soups, I mean, fish and chips, tandoori kingfish, Greek salads, then spaghetti Napolitano. So basically, something for everybody other than the Tanzanian, of course, who I'm sure would not be coming here to eat local food.
I went to see if my room was ready. It was not. How much longer do I have to wait? "That is difficult to say," the clerk replied. "The cleaners," he said, "were attending a meeting. They are making big protests about the racist Rhodesian fascists." After about an hour, I was summoned by the clerk. "A little problem has arisen," he said. "The cleaners cannot get into the room to clean it." He smiled affably at me. I remained calm. "Why is that?" "The keys have been lost," he laughed heartily. "I also have some good news for you. I have discovered there is another room we can give you."
"But I have to wait until it has been cleaned?"
His laughter swelled. "No, it has already been cleaned. You can move in straight away." I sat on the bed and collected myself before calling the reception desk.
"What kind of hotel is this?"
"This is five-star hotel.
The bed in my room was unmade."
"I'll send somebody to make it for you."
"The towels weren't clean."
"I'll send someone with clean towels."
"The hot water doesn't work."
A short silence at the other end. Then, "Nobody has ever complained about the hot water before." Mr. Hankel, a management expert, had been sent out to Tanzania by the United Nations. Mrs. Hankel, after 3 months in Arusha, was close to breakdown. "Listen," she said, "it's driving me crazy. I can't get butter, can't get milk, I can't get cheese, I can't get frankfurters. What do people here live on?" I knew what she meant. The shelves of the shops were bare.
I was standing in the middle of huge freezer cabinets that have just about every frozen food you can imagine, from fish to meat to smoked bacon. In Shivanaipal's time when he was writing, it was the scarcity he talks about in a country that's an agricultural country, the scarcity of goods, the scarcity of shops, and really how the system had collapsed and failed. What you now have is a complete contrast of what they tried to do away with, which is capitalism. And what has it delivered? Abundance. You can have just about anything. But yes, poverty remains. Nobody's pretending that every Tanzanian can come to this supermarket. The other thing you notice in a supermarket such as this is the growing influence of South Africa. This was a country that was once considered one of the frontline states in the fight against apartheid. So the irony of me standing in ShopRite, a South African supermarket chain full of South African goods, I still find incredible, because in my lifetime I had a stamp in my passport that said anywhere but South Africa, and Tanzania was very much at the forefront of that fight against South Africa, as South Africa then was.
My name is John Okshana, managing director of Garden Limited. I remember we met in
we've been in Kampala.
Several times
in Kampala,
Ghana.
And in Ghana. I was just saying, how can you contrast somebody like yourself when you try to go to a shop in 1978? Compare that to
different, very different, because it was the time when we can hardly buy soaps from the shops. Now everything is here, and you can get everything in the shops.
Yeah. So basically, life is much better.
Much better.
So was Nyerere wrong?
I don't think that he was. I'm not saying that he was wrong, but I think he was misled. The system now is good. Nyerere was misled.
Over there, the noise that's coming is a Coca-Cola promotion. In the 1970s, Coca-Cola was seen as the sort of enemy of development, especially here in Tanzania. The rapper is talking about the various presidents and the extolling the virtues of Tanzania. But, you know, it's rap music being blasted out at a Coca-Cola stand while actually paying homage to socialism. So the ironies abound. It's wonderful. This, in many ways, epitomizes the new Africa, where consumption is fine. And yes, there is poverty, but people, young people, and those that have made it, there's no fear in showing your wealth and how well you're doing, and actually consuming those goods that were once the preserve only of Western countries. What it actually also has done is that it reduces the gap between African societies and Western societies. And the other thing that has done that is the growth of international broadcasting, because we watch similar television programs. Television has meant that the gap has really narrowed between the West and Africa.
The road out of town was in a truly terrible state. We swerved crazily from verge to verge, dodging the potholes, some of which were the size of small craters. The road looked as if it had been pounded by murderous artillery.
One of the things you see that has changed in Dar es Salaam and Tanzania as a whole, actually, is the greatly improved roads compared to when Shiva Naipaul was traveling around the country. The downside is that the traffic is so incredible that although the roads are smoother and better, you can't get through them that quickly because of the sheer volume of traffic. Now, in some ways, that is good because it means that the economy has grown, people are earning a lot more and are able to buy a car. In those times, it was just a phenomenal thing to be able to afford to buy a car, so there wasn't very many on the roads.
There are no classes in the sophisticated Marxist sense in Tanzania, only peasants, party officials, and aid workers. Class struggle, since it does not exist, has to be invented. Marxism, like Christianity before it, has been reduced to a caricature in Africa.
I've come here to Kawe Beach in the north of Dar es Salaam, where I've come to meet Adam Lesekelo, who in many ways has seen Tanzania right through the independence period, having been born just before, and his father was involved in the first government of Julius Nyerere, the then leader of Tanzania. Adam, socialism has been dropped. What do you have now?
I think we have confusion, if you ask me. We went full speed to capitalism, and there's no capital. It's a mixed economy, but you see, it's a confused economy. The biggest worry here is that we're creating classes. We've got a class of very rich people and a class of very poor people. And these classes are growing, and we're going to have a clash sooner or later.
What would you say is the place of Tanzania today? Is it a success? Has it been a failure? Or is it both?
Both. It has been a failure. We still are fumbling on what to do with the economy. We haven't empowered our people. And it's a success in that we are not machine gunning each other. Nyerere forged a nation. I'm very proud of being a Tanzanian. I'm a Tanzanian full stop.
Here at Slipway on a Sunday evening, people have come to eat, drink, and look at shops full of designer goods. It's a real mixture of Tanzanians of African, Asian, and Arabic origin, and there are even Europeans and Chinese people too, all mingling happily. Their children playing and running around, while women covered head to toe in black burqas walk past scantily clad young women without butting an eyelid. Everyone seems to have a mobile phone, while quite a few are taking advantage of the free Wi-Fi to check their emails on their laptops.
While it seems to vindicate Nyerere's dream of a peaceful and united nation, I wonder what he would have made of the distance Tanzania has travelled from his dream of a socialist revolution.
We drove past a compound filled with scores of Chinese trucks used during the building of the Great Uhuru Railway. This railroad built by the Chinese links the Zambian copper belt with the port of Dar es Salaam. The Chinese are our best friends, remarked Abdullah. Despite the machinations of the imperialists, we have made a great deal of progress in Tanzania. The pat phrases, unleavened by thought, came pouring out of Abdullah's mouth. Did Abdullah really understand the nonsense he spouted?
We've come to a national trade fair in Dar es Salaam being held on a Saturday, and there's streams of people. It's an indication of the way Tanzania has embraced the world of business and trade. You wouldn't have expected to see something like this, say, 20, 30 years ago, where with international companies competing at a show like this. So you have a European company in Volvo competing against a Korean company in Hyundai with the various products. But it shows you how much these companies are putting into actually trying to woo buyers and to win business in a place such as Tanzania. This poster has Uhuru on it. Very different to what it meant at independence. Uhuru meant liberation in terms of political liberation from Britain, the colonial master. Now it seems to be used in a commercial sense, freedom to buy and sell anything that you want. In this particular case, freedom to have a mobile phone that can roam anywhere in the world. And so it seems as if the old slogan has been adopted for the very new Tanzania that we are in today. The competition between mobile phone companies is just amazing. That one says free calls for 90 days. But this one says 50% off. This one is highlighting its internet services that you can get on its phones. Africa is perhaps the fastest growing market for mobile telephony. When I first started as a reporter covering the African mobile telephone company some 15 years ago, many said there isn't really going to be a market for mobile telephony because Africans are too poor. And yet we see that this now is the playground for some of the biggest companies, including Bharti from India, Vodafone from the UK, and Orange from France. This now is the playground to try and get a slice of that burgeoning market.
For days, the newspaper and radio had been full of the impending eclipse of the sun. One writer even suggested that it should be interpreted as a triumph for socialism. The fact that the sun was about to go out over Tanzania was a portent of supreme revolutionary significance. Shortly before 7 o'clock, as though a cloud had suddenly passed over the face of the sun, the bright morning light suddenly dimmed. The air seemed peculiarly still. A dog howled. It was like a signal. The shadow began to shrink. Gradual color and life returned to the world. The tropical morning reasserted itself.
I'm having lunch with a friend of mine, Richard Ngamba, of the IPP Media Group, where he is a journalist. The media scene has changed in Tanzania over the last 15, 20 years. How would you characterize those changes?
You remember in 1990s, we were also forced to introduce multi-party system as part of the expansion of democracy. And to have that, the country was also forced to liberalize the media sector. Previously, the media was controlled by the state and the ruling party. So from 1990, we started seeing the explosion of the independent media.
And are you completely free as a journalist in Tanzania these days?
The problem we have right now is not about the freedom. It's about the quality of the content that you produce, are they holding the state accountable where the state has gone wrong, or are they really serving the public interest, or we are just serving the ruling cliques or the politicians who always manipulate the editorial? The biggest revenue comes from the advertisement. The number one advertiser is the government. So what they are doing right now, if you hammer them, they will drain your revenue. They cut down advertisement. This is what we are experiencing right now.
But have you found any particular stories that you cannot report? For instance, corruption is something that has been talked about right across Africa. And here in Tanzania, I mean, there's been some really big stories in Tanzania, including senior officials having to resign. So have you been able to hold the government to account?
We have been able to report about it. Corruption is not just about resignation and being condemned. If you have resigned, we need to see legal action being taken.
Do you see a future for Tanzania?
Yeah, I see a future, because we got our independence in 1961 with one lecturer, one medical doctor qualified, two professors. Today, when you look back, we have done something. My only disappointment with Tanzania and Africa in general is we are not ready to take responsibility for our failure. We are blaming colonialism for everything. We are blaming donors for everything. But we forget one thing. In 1961, Malaysia, Ghana, South Korea, Tanzania were at par in terms of the economic performance. Tanzania and Ghana, we are sinking deep, and we are still blaming the same colonialism. We have to take responsibility that we failed after 50 years of independence. Now, what's the way forward?
Do you know the way forward?
First, Africa is not poor. Africa is broke. And Africa is broke because of mismanagement of resources and poor leadership. We need committed leaders who knows that I have 5 years to deliver. Failure to that, I'll be out.
The publications of the house were neatly arrayed on the shelves lining the walls of the room. Class Struggles in Tanzania by Issa Shivji promised to discuss the emergence of contradictions between workers and the peasants and the decline of the Asian-dominated commercial bourgeoisie, including several famous cases of manager lockouts and factory takeovers.
When Naipaul was traveling around Dar es Salaam, who went into the bookshop of the publishing house, and of course all he could see was books extolling the virtues of socialism, a bookshop today in Dar es Salaam looks very different. What you have here is a lot of management and self-help books, including management accounting, fundamentals of human resource management, software engineering. So in other words, books that will help you improve your life, which is the new ethos, I think, that is very much being pushed.
Comrade Shivji also surfaced in another publication, The Silent Class Struggle, in which is examined the restructuring of the social behavior and attitudes of a hitherto oppressed, dominated people.
A person like Shiva Naipaul, whose observations are extremely superficial, who hardly understood Tanzania, let alone, I mean, he did not understand Africa at all. Whatever one may say about independence in Africa, we should not forget one thing, that this is one continent where 5 centuries of plunder and exploitation, 2 centuries of which there was slave trade, and a century of colonialism. No other continent has gone through that. So when independence came, the continent was left in total shadows. And that's a continent that was inherited by nationalized leaders.
Professor Shivji, just behind your chair, sitting here in your office, there's a wonderful quote on the wall which says, for a Tanzanian leader, he must be forbidden to be arrogant, extravagant, contemptuous, and oppressive. Is that how you see the current leadership?
Yes, because these days there is a lot of talk about good governance. The Arusha Declaration never talked about good governance. It talked about good leadership. And for me, there's a big difference. And that quotation is about who is a good leader. And just above that, there is a quotation from the Arusha Declaration of what was the vision.
I mean, the quotation above that says, we have been oppressed a great deal, we have been exploited a great deal, now we must have a revolution which brings to an end our weaknesses so that we are never again exploited, oppressed, or humiliated. Do you think Tanzania is now being exploited, oppressed, and humiliated?
And particularly humiliated, yes. when you cannot make your own decisions. And there cannot be a greater humiliation than that.
But who's making the decisions? You've got a leadership, you've got a president, you've got a party, you've got who's making those decisions?
You've got all the paraphernalia. And don't forget, in many cases, of course, these are the policies which were required to be adopted by the IMF, the World Bank, and the so-called donor community. Because the government no longer set their own priorities. Now, that has what has been taken away from the African states. These things are dictated to them.
I've now crossed over to the Department of History to meet Natasha Shivji, who's an assistant lecturer in the department. Natasha, my first question has to be, is it in the mandates of this university that there must always be a Shivji?
No, of course not.
All right. I've been going around Tanzania and revisiting some of the places that Shivani Paul would have seen on his journey 30 years ago. It's a very different Tanzania that you have from 30 years ago. You as a young person now, did you know about some of the things it talks about? The way everybody believed in socialism, but yet it seemed to provide nothing.
Of course, it didn't touch me in the same way as it did to people who are in their adult ages living through it. But I have heard a great deal from what happened then, and of course today it affects us in that we don't want to go back there. However, from what I've read and what I've heard, I do feel that Nyerere's socialism brought about a sense of hope, a sense of anticipation for something better, that lingering faith that something could come out of our struggles for independence. Whereas today we've even lost that faith that something can happen. We simply live in the day-to-day life. So while our shops may be full, you really have a large discrepancy between the rich and the poor, and those who are benefiting from capitalism today and the liberalization policies starting in the 80s are really, again, the urban elite.
But the mantra seems to be foreign investment that will create jobs, that will help our countries out of the poverty that still exists. So are you saying that is wrong?
Wrong? It hasn't worked. Foreign investment has not done anything for the peasants living in the worst conditions possible.
Outside in the bright sunshine, women wrapped in colorful clothes queued patiently, waiting to have their babies weighed by the Swedish volunteer. There were flies everywhere, settling around the eyes of the children and their mothers, feeding greedily on sores, spreading the infections which the clinics sought to combat. I watched the Swedish girl weighing the babies. Roughly half were below the recommended minimum weight for their age. The mothers of these starvelings were doled out rations of cooking oil, soya flour and cornmeal, gifts, as the cans and boxes and sacks in the storeroom proclaimed, of the people of the United States of America.
My question is simply this. Is capitalism a real alternative for Africa today?
And do you think that socialism is the answer?
I'm saying something like socialism, call it whatever you may, but not capitalism that we have seen, which is causing devastation in this country, in Africa. The plunder that is going on is the kind of plunder that you had during the colonial era.
It's a warehouse of cheap Chinese goods, from the most gaudy painted pictures to just about everything, from plastic toys to children's clothing, handbags. Where are you from?
China, yeah.
Which part of China?
Harbin.
And what is it that you're selling here?
Bedsheet and watches.
How do you find doing business in Africa?
No problem, good.
Yeah, all right. Okay, thank you very much. I think you've got a customer. So you better go.
Okay.
Thank you.
Tanzania cites the Chinese experience as the ultimate justification for revolutionary fervor. But what works in China, all too patently, does not work in Tanzania. Why? Because the Chinese experience has no relevance to anyone but the Chinese and the people of similar cultural background. Of all the misconceptions and delusions underlying the Tanzanian socialist revolution, this perhaps
is the greatest. That the Chinese experience can be utilized by the Tanzanians. Nothing could be further from the truth.
To me, China is not the good partner. It used to be in the 70s when